ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. How often do you actually clock off when your shift is meant to end? Or is the idea of having a defined shift, let alone one that has an end point, kind of laughable to you? We have laws now that are meant to protect our right to disconnect from work outside working hours. We've had them for more than a year, but the data says we're doing the same amount of unpaid overtime. How do we claw it back? Also ahead, the trailer for The Devil Wears Prada sequel has dropped, a casual 19 years after the original movie, and it hints at a very different kind of power dynamic, which got me thinking about what quality mentorship looks like. I'd love to hear about your mentors, the gentle and the terrifying, this morning. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, this Friday, another wave of students will stream out of the school gates for the very last time. Some will be scrambling for signatures on their graduation jerseys. Some will be pulling off those final muck-up day pranks. And tens of thousands will be marking this turning point in their lives by making the pilgrimage to schoolies. Since the 1970s, schoolies has been an Aussie rite of passage, once defined by sunburn, booze, and the sandy chaos of the Gold Coast. But things have shifted. Young people are ditching surfers paradise and heading instead for the calmer waters of Fiji or Vanuatu. But here's the question. Does a rite of passage lose something if it's all smooth sailing? Isn't growing up meant to involve a couple of rough edges, things that you laugh at or cringe about later? Or is it a good thing that today's school leavers are rewriting the script and ditching the binge drinking and redefining what makes this milestone meaningful in the first place? With me is Grace Richards, the Growth and Marketing Manager at schoolies.com, which is the official bookings website for schoolies, which is now in its 37th year. Grace, schoolies is middle-aged.
Yeah, we've had definitely a few decades of amazing history.
So you work for schoolies. Did you go to schoolies?
Oh, I was kind of dreading if you'd ask that, Tegan, but I'm actually originally from Tassie, and as you probably know, we do things a little bit differently down there. And if you grew up in a rural area like I did, you actually moved to the city for year 11 and 12. And so traditionally leavers dinners are more of a thing down in Tassie. So what I actually did for my schoolies is I improvised a bit and held a week-long party at my house.
Nice.
Which, looking back, kind of makes a lot of sense because I've ended up working for schoolies and I've always had a bit of party at my heart and core.
Fair enough. So you're throwing a heck of a party this year on the Gold Coast. How many people are you expecting?
Yeah, of course. So this year, the actual class of 2025 is slightly bigger than the class of 2024. So we're actually expecting about 20,000 plus on the Gold Coast for week one, which is still the biggest celebration by a long shot. And in week one, it's kind of where all the major kind of official parties and our events are happening.
When you say the class of 2025 is bigger, do you mean the number of people graduating high school this year nationally or just the number of people who've enrolled or, you know, booked in for schoolies proper?
A bit of both. So number, like a slightly higher graduating year, and then we're seeing a slightly increased numbers across the board, across all destinations. We manage 17 for schoolies enrolments this year.
Where else are you managing apart from the Gold Coast, which is the one that everyone knows?
Yeah, of course. So the other big ones domestically would be Busselton Leavers. They kind of do things a little bit differently over in WA as well, as well as Byron Bay, and then also Airlie Beach. Internationally, we've got Bali, Fiji, and for the first time ever, Vanuatu.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Talking about schoolies today, Grace Richards is with schoolies.com, and Diego's called in. Diego, you're finishing school. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Where are you going to celebrate?
So we're going to Vanuatu for the first time, and we're all so pumped. We've got a massive group, about 30 to 40 people that I know going. So, yeah, we just can't wait.
That is a huge...
Leaving in about a week, I think.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. How exciting. What made you choose Vanuatu?
So a lot of us have been to, like, Fiji and, like, Bali, and we've all visited Australia a lot, like, in my friend group, and we kind of wanted to go somewhere new. And some people haven't actually been in a plane before as well, and so they really wanted to, like, just step foot out of Australia and visit a place, like, new, you know, different environment, different atmosphere and landscape. And so we kind of all agreed on Vanuatu because it was just a new location and it was cost friendly as well. So we all decided to step foot in Vanuatu for schoolies, and we're looking forward to it.
How long have you been thinking about finishing school and how you wanted to celebrate it?
Oh, it's just been crazy because, like, school, it can be hard sometimes, I'll admit, especially the HSC, completing the HSC. And so every time we're, like, studying for 3 hours straight, we just look up at each other and we're like, I cannot wait for school. Like, we've said that about a million times because we've just seen so much of the feed and, like the promotion stuff. And it's just, it looks amazing. Like, the photos look amazing, people celebrating in remote places. It just looks amazing. So we've been thinking about it for ages. I'm pretty sure we booked it in, like, a year ago, pretty much from today. And yeah, we've just been so pumped to go on this trip and celebrate in a unique way.
Well, Diego, I hope you have the best time, that it's super fun and safe, because I'm a mum and I'm worried about you, but I'm sure you'll have a great time. Thank you so much for the call. Charles, what was your unconventional end of school celebration?
My best mate and I thought Stuff Surfers and Byron will go really wild. So we got the train up to his grandparents' place at Port Macquarie, New South Wales, Florida, retirement homes. And on the train, there were no seats, so we slept on the floor. And the guard came down and he said, you can't do that. Hop up into the luggage rack and you can sleep up there as well. So we did that. And then so we stayed with his grandparents for a fortnight. They're a lovely old couple. And had scones and cups of tea multiple times, and played Scrabble and Cluedo and did crosswords, and it was just wild.
Scones, cups of tea, Scrabble and Cluedo sounds like an amazing week, actually. Charles, thank you so much for the call. Well, also with me is Dan Woodman, Professor in Sociology at the University of Melbourne. You know Dan because he usually joins me on Thursdays for our chat, which is called Social Studies. But because he knows everything about generational changes, I thought I'd pull you out of the mothballs for today. Dan, welcome back to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan.
What do we know about how different schoolies has been over the years? We've got Diego jetting off to Vanuatu with his 40 of his closest friends next week. And then we've got Charles, who had cups of tea and scones not that long ago. Charles didn't sound that old, but a while ago now.
Yes. So I'm probably more on the cup of tea and scones end of the scale. I don't have partying at my core like Grace does. But our schoolies' experiences, have changed, as you were saying. It's kind of from the 70s in the 80s, really, where it became a thing. We've celebrated finishing school for a lot longer than that. So people will know the movie Grease is around celebrating the end of high school and that transition back in the 1950s. But the thing to remember is that most people who finished school in Australia up to the 1980s, unfortunately, sorry for the listeners who are in this cohort, you probably weren't the pink ladies. You weren't that cool. Because until the 1980s, only about one third of Australians did go through to the end of year 12. So you were finishing with a smaller cohort of more academically minded folk, and you know when you finished you'd go out either for some nice scones or maybe a dinner and a few drinks, but it wasn't the mass experience of a shared collective rite of passage that it's become more recently.
We are talking about schoolies and how you marked your end of school years here today on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Professor Dan Woodman, who's a sociologist at the University of Melbourne, and Grace Richards, who's with schoolies.com, which is like the official schoolies booking service here in Australia. And I'm really enjoying your texts. Someone says, in 1971, I climbed through the year 12 room window onto the roof with mates with a bottle of bubbles and chips. That was it. Greg says, schoolies was unheard of in South Australia in the 70s, so we did nothing. I simply worked in the SA Railways as a temporary youth refresh labourer. In brackets, my dad was my boss. Another says, my schoolies with three friends was camping and bushwalking on Flinders Island in the Bass Strait. Only one of us was old enough to drive, in brackets, legally. It involved a light plane flight to get there, very expensive camper van hire, amazing scenery, nature and history. A trip I remember well. Jacob has called in. How did you mark the end of school, Jacob?
Hi, Tegan. Hi, Dan. It's a little while now, back in 2017. But when we graduated, I was at a boarding school in Perth, and what about 20 boarders of us? I reckon not one went to leavers. We actually all, being from the wheat belt in the countryside, we actually worked on CBH, the grain receival sites out that way. So I think all of us just spent harvest working, and then the following year either went to uni or in my case, I just took a gap year and continued to work on the family farm for about another 6 months, and then did the Camino in Spain.
Nice.
And spent about 5 months in Europe on the money I made over summer. So, instead of spending my money on a couple of weeks of leavers, I was able to earn about 20, 30 grand and then go and spend all that in Europe instead. And I had a wicked time with the Contiki and the Camino.
6 months of delayed schoolies gratification. Jacob, thank you so much for the call. On the text line, one person says, pity the people of Vanuatu, an onslaught of grossly behaved Australian teenagers descending on them. Grace, talk to me about the, I guess, standards of behaviour and what it means when Aussie kids are sort of travelling en masse to places like Vanuatu and Fiji.
From my perspective, I see every year, and I think this is a tribute to both young people themselves, their parents and schools, they actually behave better than ever. Like, gone are the years where we saw riots on the street and people acting up all kind of crazy and things like that. We're actually seeing young people being really respectful and just absolutely lovely humans. So I actually experience, and everyone that kind of works with us and experiences schoolies would reflect and say that. I think there's definitely like a generational kind of perception of what schoolies act and behave like when they get together. But really, it's just young people coming together celebrating the end of school.
What kind of things are they doing?
Yeah. So in terms of, one of the things that I'd say that we've noticed a shift in terms of how they celebrate, it's always been about finishing school, celebrating with mates. Next thing that they want to do is obviously meet new people. The third thing is always party. And now I think the newest thing that they really want to do is experience something like it is a complete travel experience. So if you look at the different destination, that's slightly different in terms of how it manifests. So for instance, in Vanuatu or in Fiji, we run wellness activities in the morning. So your yoga and Pilates. We do cultural kind of immersion trips. We're out on the reef snorkeling and having activities as well as those kind of parties. On the Gold Coast, it's slightly different. So we obviously design things for mass here. So we run a major festival out at Doug Jennings Park called Schoolies Nation. That's with Peking Duck. We do things like pool parties at the Hilton, launch parties, and this year for the very first time we're taking thousands of young people out to Dreamworld for Dreamworld Day Out. These kind of activities and what they're wanting changes year on year, and really Schoolies is a reflection, or schoolies.com is a reflection of what the young people are kind of asking for.
Dan, it's so interesting hearing Grace talking about yoga and Pilates on the beach for 17-year-olds when the stereotype of school is pretty different to that. We know that Gen Z drinks less as a generation. These schoolies are a bit younger than that. But how does that play into the way they want to celebrate?
Yeah, so culturally there absolutely has been a shift. But as Grace was saying, partying is still fairly high up the list. And a lot of people at schoolies do still have too much alcohol. And for some, it might be their first experience of doing that. So it is a big group of young people and partying. So behavior absolutely is not perfect, and some people don't behave well. But overall, this cohort is probably a little bit more sensible than the ones that have come before that might be now the parents of the young people heading off and remembering with a bit of cringe and some fear, you know, what they got up to as 18-year-olds. But the mix of activities is broader than just going to the pub with schoolies now.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Professor Dan Woodman from the University of Melbourne and Grace Richards from schoolies.com talking about end of school rites of passage. Rachel, you graduated on the Gold Coast, but before schoolies was a thing. What did you do to celebrate?
Yeah, well, I was always wondering when schoolies started. I finished in 1977, so it was really interesting to hear that it started in 78. We were 17, so our year 12 went to the Iluka like motor inn. It was on the beach at Surface. I don't know if it's still there. No alcohol. For us, or for me and my friends, the party started afterwards in those days.
But without getting these funds that were promised, we can't finish what we started out to do.
Multiple emails and letters seen by ABC investigations to both Premier Jacinta Allen and...
I'm so sorry, Rachel. We just had a weird thing happen with the lines there. Go on. You were talking about not drinking, and then you were sounded like you were winding around to something different.
Well, there was, because we were 17, there was no alcohol at the venue, so it was just like, you know, waiting for that part for me and my friends to be over so we could go to the bottle shop and get all our alcohol. I never thought that was really exciting, the organised bit. And I was really interested to hear the professor earlier say that in those days, the people that were still there at year 12 were the academic ones. Well, that wasn't the case for me because I wasn't allowed to leave at year 10. So that wasn't my experience.
Rachel, thank you so much for the call. It's interesting you make that comment about wanting to leave early but not. Jenny, that's sort of a little bit what happened with your son.
Yeah, hi, how are you going?
Good, good. Tell me your son's story.
Yeah, so he was in year 11. He wanted to leave. He managed to sort of stay on. Then year 12 came. He wanted to leave. And then we had the big meeting with the principal, and I thought it was going to be very much like, knuckle down, get good grades, gives you more options for life and university. And all she really said was, you know, it'd be a real shame if you don't get to go to schoolies and do all those end of year things with your mates. And that was it, and then he just stayed. So I thought that was quite clever, actually, rather than sort of going the academic route. She was basically kind of going the what's in it for me, in my shoes. Very smart woman. I mean, I was shocked when it kind of fell out of her mouth, but then I realised, actually, that's pretty smart.
So schoolies was a carrot that kept your son in school till the end of year 12. And I'm loving your text as well. A lot of... A theme coming through in the text line. One person says, I left school in 1974. In those days, we marked the occasion by getting a job. True, no celebration at all. And Anne says, I can't help thinking that the people spending their or their parents' money on extravagant schoolie celebrations will soon be complaining that they can't buy a house. I'm 65. After school, I immediately got a summer job. And yes, I do own my home. Dan, talk to me about the value of a rite of passage and a memorable experience, and maybe the value of keeping your money in your pocket.
I was laughing about that comment about saving money and buying a house because this generation is maybe a little bit more likely than the previous to actually make it out for breakfast during schoolies and buy that famous avocado toast. But you know, I've done a back of the envelope calculation. It's something like 30,000 avocado toast breakfast before you can afford a deposit in our big cities now. So schoolies is not the reason why it's hard to get into the housing market. And for Australians, we sometimes think of it as like the first rite of passage in young people's lives, but in some ways it's the last shared rite of passage, because now we have a large number of our 17, 18-year-olds do finish high school. But after that, the life course is messier than it used to be. People do get married, don't get married, move out of home, don't move out of home, move back, have kids, don't, at a greater spread of ages across a life course. So in a way, this will be the last really shared experience with a group that you've gone through something for years with, and you've gone through it together as an age cohort. And I think it's really important to be able to mark and celebrate that.
Grace, is that what you hear from the kids who are booking with you?
Yeah, I think, like, on that point, just to take it in a slightly different direction, I would say that, like, the majority of the people that head to schoolies, there is a proportion that are basically using cash from mum and dad to help fund their trip. But the bulk majority are actually self-funding. So they're getting jobs at Macca's, they're working in their first jobs. It actually shows, like, the amount of dedication and hard work that young people put in to actually getting to their celebration, not only schoolwork, but also to get there, is also a credit to them as well.
So, Grace, another thing that one of the previous callers talked about, the fact that when she graduated from high school, at least in Queensland, you were 17. That's changed now. A lot of the school leavers are now over 18 and can legally drink at schoolies events. What sort of safety measures are you putting in place, or are you kind of advising the kids of? Because even though they're 18, they're still pretty new to this.
Yeah, so there's a whole host of safety measures that are kind of put in place. And I would say that as a generation, young people are already doing the ones that make common sense. So looking out for their mates, staying in groups. With safety kind of being number one, I think one of the great support services that happens across all of our destinations is obviously the Red Frogs, that act as a referral and peer support service to young people around drinking and drinking behaviours. And they're there to call on if you do need support, as well as your traditional kind of mental health support agencies, ambulance and police that are there as well. One thing that I'd like to say on the 18-year-old, we're actually starting to see the scales kind of flip to seeing more 18-year-olds at schoolies and less 17-year-olds, which is really important. Why, say, for example, in Gold Coast Week 1, we have things like all age inclusive events, so ones that are designed for under 18-year-olds. Like, we have underage clubs that happen that are completely alcohol free zones, but that all ages can kind of attend as long as they have a schoolies lanyard.
I will say, tomorrow here on Life Matters, we're going to be talking about schoolies again on a more serious note, because changes to Queensland's laws mean schoolies on the Gold Coast won't have access to pill testing this year, and talking about how to keep your young person safe. So if that's in the back of your mind, then come back tomorrow, because we'll be talking about it on Life Matters. But a couple more of your stories. Andrew on the text line says, schoolies on the Gold Coast was great till it started going off in the 90s as people in their 20s turned up starting to prey on the school leavers. I'm now seeing school leavers having different rites of passage, going camping with friends or travelling to new places other than the Gold Coast where they can have fun and celebrate in a way that's meaningful for them. Good for them. And Alan says, I graduated from Warragul Tech in 1976. Only 7 of us did year 12. So our schoolies, we went to the pub. It's a really big change over the course of a generation. Grace, Dan, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, guys.
Grace Richards is a growth and marketing manager at schoolies.com, and Dan Woodman, your fave, is a professor in sociology at the University of Melbourne. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, because up next, we're talking about the fact that today is Go Home on Time Day. But how likely is it that you'll actually clock off when you're meant to?
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Think about your average workday for a sec. Do you come in right at your designated time and then leave exactly when the clock strikes knockoff? Chances are you mean to, but there's always like one more document you need to send, or when you get home, your phone pings because, of course, you've got your work emails connected to your phone. And before you know it, you've donated an hour of your time just tidying up loose ends. Well, the National Right to Disconnect laws were meant to tackle work-life imbalance. They came into effect last August, but not much seems to have changed because we're still working for free. The average Australian worker does 3.6 hours of unpaid overtime a week. Today is National Go Home on Time Day, so we're talking about it. And I'd love to hear from you. If you've learned to switch off somehow, could you please share your secrets? And with me is Fiona McDonald, who's the director of the Centre for Future Work. Fiona, I'm surprised that we haven't seen a change in the unpaid overtime hours that we're doing.
Yeah, we have seen a bit of a change, I think. We haven't seen much change between last year and this year, a very small change, but we did see quite a significant change last year. And the fact that that's been sustained for full-time workers, at least, and perhaps is it a little less, does indicate that we could be seeing unpaid overtime for full-time workers on a slow decline. It's a lot less than it was a couple of years ago when full-time workers were doing an average of 6.2 hours unpaid overtime a week in 2023 compared with 3.8 hours this year.
That is a really big difference. Like, that's effectively a halving. Mm. So is it a cultural thing that's changed, or is it these laws that have shifted the needle, do you think?
Well, I think it's both those things. I think the laws have potentially, what's happening is the laws have shifted some workplace cultures a bit because we saw the drop last year rather than this year, even though the legislation had only just come in. But we know there's been so much discussion about it, and there was so much discussion about it prior to them coming in August 2024, that. And there has subsequently been a lot of discussion about the need for workplace policies, about changing cultures generally. And so, and maybe it's just that we're seeing workers, that difference happening without it having to be the actual laws, without people having to take individual cases, for example, to the Fair Work Commission. We're just seeing a shift in practices.
Are there particular industries where you see more unpaid overtime than others?
Yeah, there are. We see quite a bit of it in construction, which is kind of not surprising when we have a lot of building going on. We see it a lot in retail and hospitality, which is...
That's not what I would have expected.
No, well, that's really interesting because when we look at the unpaid overtime and where it's happening, it appears to be part-time workers whose unpaid overtime is not reducing. And that is, a lot of that is in retail and hospitality. And that kind of makes sense in a way because if you think about a lot of part-time jobs, it's actually, they're less likely to be impacted, I think, by the right to disconnect, because part-time work in those industries tends to be having to come in a bit early or leave a bit late to, prepare for example, in a cafe, to make sure you're ready for the customers before you, you open the doors, or to clean up at the end of the day. Or perhaps we see it also in healthcare and social assistance. Nurses are doing patient handovers. There's an ongoing complaint that there's never enough time to do those. Social care workers, that's another area where people are providing support to people in the community or in their homes, and they're facing unpredictable things every day in those kinds of jobs, as well as they have a chronic complaint of never having enough time to do their admin. So those are the part-time jobs where the spillover is not about being contacted after work or not being able to switch off, which is probably a problem more for professionals and managers, and we see that they've got high levels of unpaid overtime still. It's a problem of your job just being a bit too big.
You're listening
to be able to do it.
You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Fiona McDonald, who's the director of the Centre for Future Work at the Australia Institute, about the fact that it is Go Home on Time Day today. And even though we've had our right to disconnect laws in effect for more than a year now, we do seem to be doing about the same amount of unpaid overtime as we were a year ago. Although, as Fiona notes, it's a lot less than we were doing a couple of years ago. And I'm asking you if you've learnt to switch off in some kind of way, if you've got tips you might want to share with me and anyone else listening. One person says, I do my eight and hit the gate. Another says, I flip the cards. I'll take work calls after hours, but I'll take personal calls at work, with a winky emoji. Tim says, it's important to remember that work has changed radically in the last few decades and that many people like me have multiple jobs, very small numbers of hours, which are blended into a domestic life because, as well, so many of us work from home. I'm not sure this kind of question is relevant anymore. Fiona, is it still relevant to be talking about this?
Yeah, it is still relevant. Perhaps the moniker that we've given it, go home on time, is perhaps less relevant for many people. But unpaid overtime is very relevant. You know, if you're, most of us are paid on an hourly basis for the time that we work. And if we just take the average unpaid overtime that people reported this year in our survey, it was 3.6 hours a week. Now, that doesn't sound like an enormous amount, but that was equivalent to more than nearly 12% of their paid hours. So for more than for every 10 hours they work, they're working more than 1 hour unpaid for every 10 hours they're paid. And that amounts to 173 hours over a year. And for an employee on a median wage rate who was working full time, that's $305 a fortnight, or nearly $8,000 a year. So while people's jobs might be more flexible and we manage our own time a lot more in different jobs, if we're all doing excessive time compared to what we're being paid for, that's a problem. And I think it is still really relevant.
Yeah, $8,000 a year would go a long way. Yeah. Also with me is Dr. Ben Searle, who's an organisational psychologist, consultant and researcher. Ben, hearing what Fiona's talking about here, how does that gel with your understanding?
Oh, look, that is absolutely the experience of the people that I speak to, Tegan. It is very much an experience of doing more than is noted as the expectation of the role, but it is, we're still seeing that even with some change, we're still working long hours. We're still, we have this idea of ourselves as a laid back, easygoing country. Even last year, we were working more hours than half the countries in the OECD. We're working more hours than people in Japan. We're working more hours than people in the UK.
That's interesting. I don't think I thought it was, we sort of do, like you say, think of ourselves as being pretty laid back. Or on the other hand, I think I thought this was just a function of being digital. A lot of the time our work does follow us home because it can now. But what I'm hearing from you is that other countries with the same technology as us don't seem to have the same culture as us.
I think culture is part of this. These stories we tell ourselves about being a laid back and an easygoing culture are just stories, but something that is more concrete about the cultural experience in Australia is that we are a low power distance culture. And so a lot of the ways that work is expected, or the ways that people are encouraged to do work, is done indirectly. So in a lot of these workplaces, people aren't being told, oh, we need you to work an extra 3 hours this week that you aren't being paid. It is done through these indirect means. So sorry to everyone who is neurodiverse out there, because this is an unwritten rule that might be occurring in your workplace. So we see it through modelling. We see it through seeing what your boss does. We're seeing what your co-workers are doing. Everyone else is still in the office at 6 o'clock. And I thought, oh, shouldn't we have gone at 5? If you're getting emails from your boss at 9 p.m., you know, that communicates a couple of things. It communicates sort of an expectation that you're checking your emails after 9 p.m., but it also communicates, well, if you want to get to the level where your boss is at, you probably ought to be working to that sort of hours.
On the text,
so I think
yes, sorry,
I think those things do have an impact. Yes.
No, I was just going to put this question to you, Ben, because on the text line, someone says, it's your own responsibility. Arrive on the dot and leave on the dot. If you stay late, work a shorter day tomorrow. I love that energy. But if what you're saying is right, Ben, this is cultural thing there, it feels like you do need to help shift the culture. Like, do you have some scripts you could share on how to have these conversations with your colleagues and your boss?
Oh, look, yeah, absolutely. There are ways to have, you know, open and honest conversations with your peers, formal conversations with your boss to clarify the expectations. What are your expectations of working hours here? But ultimately, I mean, there is a responsibility of employers to create mentally healthy workplaces. And part of that responsibility is clear expectations, and you know, they bear responsibility for some aspect of the surrounds within which people are working. And it's not a minor thing. I mean, it is true that there are some people who benefit from the flexibility. You know, my wife has a disability and she works from home and she prefers to be able to be flexible with her hours. But there can be a cost. When we're thinking about work out of hours, we're not getting the same recovery benefits of being able to rest and recuperate.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Dr. Ben Searle, who's an organisational psychologist, consultant and researcher, and Fiona McDonald, who's the director of the Centre for Future Work, talking about the right to disconnect, the unpaid hours of overtime that so many of us are doing every day, every week. It adds up, as Fiona was detailing before. And I'd love to know what your relationship with unpaid overtime is. One person just says, unpaid overtime, teachers, followed by 7 exclamation marks. As someone who has a family of teachers, I think I know what you're getting at. Another text says, working as a counsellor in part-time private practice, the number of unpaid hours is enormous. Many people think the one-hour fee for services is too expensive, yet they don't consider the admin, promotion, accounting, managing bookings, case notes and reports. Well, Fiona, do you think we're ever going to get to a stage where we shift the culture enough that we're not doing this unpaid overtime?
Tegan, I'd like to think so. I think we are making inroads where it is white-collar full-time work because large organisations are having to think about that because of the right to disconnect legislation. Where I think we've got some really big problems is in those industries where such as you've just and jobs that you've just spoken about, where jobs are just sized to be too big. And they seem to be, if we look at our survey results this year, the bigger problems now seem to be perhaps with part-time jobs. So jobs where, again, you don't have that admin time, you're not given the time to do the admin, and there's a very large and growing care and support workforce who provide support in people's homes in the communities who have that as a chronic problem. Hospitality and retail jobs have that as a chronic problem. And problematically, they're the kind of lower paid jobs, and they're the jobs that are done by many young people for whom it's very difficult for a young person, potentially very difficult for them to raise this issue in that kind of work environment. And I think we do need, as Ben suggested, there are lots of ways that individuals can raise these things in work. I think that's easier for you if you are in a higher paid role, or if you've been in the workforce a while, if you're a casual or a part-time retail or hospitality worker, a young person, it's really difficult to do that. And I think we probably need some more institutional responses to that. We need perhaps some more transparency around the unpaid overtime that's being performed in workplaces. Because we know it is. We know it's rife in many workplaces. And it's not, you know, we ask in professional and managerial occupations, people kind of feel like it's their responsibility and their choice. And while it might not be, because to do a good job, you might feel like to do the work that you need to do, you feel like you have to put in more hours. And I think teachers are a very classic case of that. They want to do a good job. Nurses want to, you know, make sure that they have do a proper patient handover. Casual tutors in universities, you know, need the time to mark papers and they're not given it. But I think if for lower paid workers, it's really difficult for people to have those conversations, and we actually need some different responses. The right to disconnect is great for people who want to switch off from being contacted on phone and email, and that's the problem, but that's not the problem for everybody.
Yeah, not the only problem. Fiona, Ben, thank you both so much for joining me. Fiona McDonald is Director of the Centre for Future Work at the Australia Institute, and Dr. Ben Searle is an organisational psychologist, consultant and researcher. Loving your texts. Anna says, I do not have work email or Teams on my phone. Then when I finish work, my private life is private. Another says, I'm a partner in a law firm. I value productivity over time in office. If the work is done, they can leave early. No expectation of reasonable overtime, and work hard to enforce quality of life over hours in the office. In a culture that values overwork, we work hard and smart, not long. Well, if you like talking about work or listening to people talk about work, you'll love This Working Life with Lisa Leong. It's on 11 a.m. Fridays here on ABC Radio National, or of course, anytime on the ABC Listen app. It's good chat, and also Lisa's a delight. So check out This Working Life, but not quite yet, because next here on Life Matters, we're staying with work, kind of. I will reveal the movie trailer that's got me thinking about some of our most important work relationships.
So you're saying I'm stuck here again?
Detective Sergeant Mackenzie Clark's back on the ABC.
There's something in that town that you have to make your peace with.
Because of a certain ex-fiancé?
Aren't you meant to be in London?
Well, or does she just love a challenge?
We've got a twist for you.
How did the killer escape through a locked door?
The brand new season of the Logie Award-winning hit series,
This Is Murder,
Return to Paradise.
Impossible.
So you'd think. Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
The trailer for the second Devil Wears Prada movie has dropped, which immediately piqued my interest because that is one of my go-to sick day movies. Anyway, watching this trailer, I immediately noticed a huge change of dynamic between the two main characters. If you haven't seen this movie, basically there's Miranda Priestley, who's based on former Vogue editor Anna Wintour. She terrorised her staff, but she also serves as an unconventional mentor to Anne Hathaway's character. And the complex relationship between a professional mentor and ambitious mentee, there's fear, admiration, transformation. This new movie seems to put them on a more equal footing. And it got me thinking about the people who shape our careers, our mentors. Some teach with kindness, some with terror, whether they mean to or not. So in a moment, you'll hear from a scientist who's risen to the top and credits her mentors for her success. And you'll also hear from a career coach on what makes a good mentoring relationship. But I'd also love to hear from you about your mentor. What did they teach you and how did they teach you? And with me is Professor Naomi McClure-Griffiths. She's an astrophysicist. In 2004, she discovered a new spiral arm in the Milky Way galaxy. She was awarded the Prime Minister's Malcolm McIntosh Prize for Physical Scientist in 2006, but she chalks up her amazing achievements to the people who got her where she is. Naomi, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning. Thanks.
Tell me about your mentors.
Oh, well, mentors are everything for me. I've had a couple of good ones. Well, many good ones, but two that really stand out, I think of as being sort of like mom and dad. You know, you need those parents in your work life as much as you need them in your home life when you're developing. And I've had two wonderful ones, Professor Anne Green and Professor Ron Eakers, who really looked after me throughout my career, continue to look after me and check in on me, even though now I don't need them as much as I did when I was a wee little scientist.
Because you've left home and you're out in your adult scientist life now.
Yep.
What kind of things did they teach you?
I think the thing that they did, both of them have done incredibly well, is to empower me and believe in me far earlier than I believed in myself. So And I remember her introducing me at some point when I was just a young PhD student, introducing me as somebody who was leading the work that I was doing. And it had never occurred to me that I could be a leader or was a leader. And that sort of empowerment from her really changed the way that I looked at myself. Likewise, Ron was a person, has been throughout my career, a person who has nominated me for things when I never would have thought I could possibly get, you know, this prize or that membership into the Academy or whatever. And he put me forward for those things early, and that really boosted my confidence. And I've always been a person who needs a bit of confidence boosting.
They saw your capability before you did.
Absolutely. I think that's something that good mentors really do very well, is that they can see somebody and recognize their strengths and then help them to, you know, see those strengths in themselves.
You talk about good mentors and what they do well. Well, also with us is Nora Breekveld, who's a career coach and the author of Me and My Mentor. Nora, what are the characteristics of a really good mentoring relationship for you?
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this. Look, I agree very much with your previous speaker about mentors having the ability to empower you, to stretch you, and to advocate for you. And when you're in a good mentoring relationship, say in a work situation, you've also got somebody who can sponsor or advocate for you in situations where you may not be present. So, for example, when there are discussions about who might be a good person for a particular assignment or for a particular promotion or sideways move, if you've got somebody who's got your back and is on your side, that mentor can really advocate for you and open up opportunities for you that you otherwise may not have access to. A good mentor also is somebody who helps you to think differently about a challenge, and not just to say, well, in my experience, this is what I did, but to get you to think differently and to get you to maybe have a different perspective on a challenge you might be facing. And that's really important, because the results and the decisions that you make are always best if you've come to that conclusion yourself, rather than if you have somebody say, well, you know, my advice is you do A, B, C or D. So a good mentor really stretches you, gets you to think differently, and is a good advocate for you.
It's all very positive. We're hearing Naomi talking about these two incredible people that really kind of advocated for her throughout. And the sorts of relationships that you're talking about, Nora, are very supportive. But just to like bring it around to The Devil Wears Prada again, like in that movie, our inspiration today, the mentor is sort of almost like a dragon boss, right? Like a terrible boss. Are there people like that that can still kind of teach you something and bring out the best in you?
Definitely. When you're working with a dragon boss, that's where you often have your best learning. And when I'm coaching and mentoring women in particular, they'll often say, well, you know, I'm looking for a job where I've got a great boss and I've got a great environment. And that's great too. But actually you get your best learning when you're in difficult situations. And you'll develop your leadership capability when you learn to work with difficult people. Having said that, I don't think that a mentor shouldn't really be somebody who's in your direct line of authority. It's not always ideal having your boss as your mentor, because often there are situations that you might want to discuss with a mentor that you may not necessarily feel comfortable discussing with a boss.
That's a really interesting distinction there, because I'm thinking about sort of seniority, the chain of command, especially when you're in a lower part of your career, everyone above you is teaching you something. But what I'm hearing you say is that you can be quite selective about people who you want to have mentor you. How do you identify those people?
Well, I think first of all, you need to look around and identify who are people who I really admire, value, trust, because some of the things you are going to be talking about are likely to be highly confidential matters, and they could be about your relationship with your boss or relationship with peers of your boss or your own peers. And that's why it's often good to have somebody who knows your work environment but isn't your direct boss, so that you can talk openly and freely. The mentors, when I talk with mentees and mentors, a lot of the mentees say, well, the people that I have selected as mentors were women that I admired who maybe have been on the path that I'm on but are a few years ahead of me, who understand the political dynamics of what I'm going through and who can provide me with some fearless advice, knowing that my conversations are going to be absolutely confidential and won't go any further.
Mm. Naomi, thinking about your two incredible mentors, did you approach them or was it something that kind of grew organically?
It grew very organically. I have approached other people, you know, and later when I was more confident, but those two came to me, really sort of looked after me, even to the extent that, you know, Anne Green, I think, told me I should go to bed because I looked sick, kind of looking after me sort of thing. those ones grew up very, very organically. But I now seek out people who I think can bring sort of new insights into my way of thinking as a more mature scientist.
And Naomi, you're a mentor yourself now. What have you brought to those relationships?
I guess, you know, going back to the parenting analogy, I think I probably mentor in the way that I was mentored most effectively, in the way that we parent like we were parented. And I try to have the same degree of openness and caring, and that advocacy that we just heard about is something that I really bring into my mentoring relationship, so that I can, you know, put somebody forward for something, talk about them in a meeting in a way that's positive so that they get a little bit of airtime when they're not there. But I also try to be a very open mentor. You know, I have a box of tissues in my office and that box of tissues gets used.
Nora, thinking about if you want to approach someone for a mentoring relationship briefly, how would you advise people to begin that conversation?
Well, if you're looking, if you have somebody specifically in mind and you know that individual, often it's as simple as just saying, hey, can we catch up for a drink or a coffee, or can I buy you lunch or something? I've got something that I'd really value your advice or your perspective on. And then the relationship can grow from there. And I think that's often a really effective way of starting a relationship. You can, of course, go to somebody and say, will you be my mentor and can we meet once a month? Mm-hmm. And that can work too. But often that informal, can we just catch up? I've got something I just need another perspective on, can be a really nice way of starting a relationship. And then there isn't necessarily that formality, but you can introduce the formality of, you know, regular catch-ups if and when you need to.
Well, Nora, Naomi, thank you both so much for sharing your insights today. Nora Briegveldt is author of Me and My Mentor, and Professor Naomi McClure-Griffiths is an astrophysicist at the Australian National University and chief scientist of the SKA Observatory. And I'm loving your texts. One person says, I worked with a Miranda Priestly when I worked in the fashion buying office of a major retail organisation. While it was hard, I learned how to plan and manage time and business information. To this day, I still use the techniques. Jan says, my mentors were older staff members who taught me all the things we didn't learn at Teachers College. And another says, the best mentor gives the mentee the confidence to follow their own ideas and instincts. Thank you so much for your text on the way you celebrated your end of your schooling years. Did you schoolie or did you do something else? Well, Karen says, there were no pink ladies in 1978. Finished school with a David Bowie concert at Lang Park and an all-weekend party at Brookfield in the west of Brisbane. We certainly managed a memorable finale to school. Kate says, back in the 80s and as a boarder, skipped Leavers Booze Up and went on a push bike ride with a few other schoolies fitness fans to the top of from the top of Mildura to Melbourne. And push we did. Strong wind and rain most of the way. It taught us the value of great adventures and we made lots of new friends from country town to town. Great choice and great ride. We also spoke about going home on time. It's Go Home on Time Day. Teachers, my husband is paid to work 3 days per week spread over 4 days. He has meetings 3 evenings a week and would work 10 hours a week over what he is paid for. He spends most mornings before he leaves for work and most evenings catching up with emails and communication. He has teachers and parents contact him after hours and on weekends. And Kim from South Yarra says, my daughter is a midwife and often works extra hours. Babies come when they're ready. Yeah, you really can't take a newborn baby to the Fair Work Commission, can you? Well, that is almost it for Life Matters coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about schoolies again, like I said, but on a more serious note. Changes to Queensland's laws mean schoolies on the Gold Coast won't have access to pill testing this year. So how do you keep your young person safe? Plus, age discrimination in healthcare is real. What can we do about it? Don't forget, you can get in touch with me or the Life Matters team anytime. You can just email us, lifematters@abc.net.au. We love hearing from you. And I'll catch you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.